right, all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. Yeah. See, that's what gets me going. And it's sort of like it just builds up and then it bursts out. And one day, the top of my head is just going to blow off. All right? So, because I just like that song. And it just drives me up. It drives me crazy. All right? And it's a really old song. I think I first heard it when I was like 8, you know? So it's a cool thing. All right. Well, I'm really glad to be here with you today. And I'm really looking forward to our guests on the show today. You know, this show ended up being a show all about Palestine. Now, it didn't start out that way, but basically, when I was preparing for my interview with our first guest, it really struck me that we really need to give people a lot of background information and help them understand exactly what is going on with Palestine and why are people of conscience all over the world, why is it necessary for all of us to actually stand up and say no to what the U.S. imperialists and their little lapdogs in Israel, the Zionist government, are doing to the Palestinian people. To stand up and say we won't remain silent in the face of this terrible, terrible crime against humanity. So at the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I did with a person who's actually really extremely well-known in Palestine and around the world as a person of integrity, honesty, and who's dedicated his entire life to righting the terrible wrongs that have been visited upon the Palestinian people. His name is Salman Abu Sitta. And for decades, his name has been a byword for a cogent, reasoned insistence on the legality, morality, and practicality of the right of return of the Palestinian refugees. And he is probably best known for his groundbreaking project, mapping historic Palestine and developing a practical plan for implementing the right of return of Palestinian refugees. And I decided to revisit this interview with Salman Abu Sitta now because I thought it was really important to give context to what our first guest is going to talk about. Opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be bringing you Alice Rothschild, the author of Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel-Palestine.
Since 2003, obstetrician Alice Rothschild has traveled annually to Israel/Palestine with other concerned Americans to learn about the health and human rights situation of politically marginalized communities, especially Palestinians. Condition Critical explores everyday life in Israel, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza, and the everyday struggle of people to resist attempts to erase them and their history from the earth. And I have to tell you, as I said, it's a book that is going to, you're going to be a different person when you come out the other end, right? It's just something that's, I would say, I actually haven't seen anything like this in quite some time. And I, as people know, I've done a lot of study around Palestine. I've interviewed a lot of people around Palestine, many, all of whom were good in other ways. But this, in terms of giving you an actual, just a vision and an understanding of what the people are going through on the ground. This is an incredibly important book on that level, all right, especially for these days. So I want to welcome Alice Rothschild to the show. Alice, welcome.
Welcome to you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. As I said, I'm really looking forward to this. So I'm going to jump in, okay?
Okay.
All right. Why this book now? You know, you've written two other books on Gaza, and now your latest book is, like I said, titled Condition Critical, Life and Death in Palestine/Israel. Why this book? What made you feel like you had to write this book now?
So my first book was more about my own journey as a Jewish American, learning about Palestine, learning about the mythology of Israel that I was brought up with and raising all sorts of questions. And it told the stories of different Israelis and Palestinians that were my educators. And my second book was a blog-to-book book that happened where a publisher called me and said, "You've been in the region blogging, I want to publish your blog." So it happened really quickly. This book is a combination of both blogging and either curated blogs as well as political analysis. So I'm really taken with how difficult it is for many people to think and talk about this topic. And so I think that there is a tremendous power in using the personal narrative and telling stories about people rather than having some political polemic kind of conversation. So I try to use my on-the-ground blogging, which I do every time I go, to really educate people about individuals, their daily reality, the challenges of living under siege, under occupation, et cetera, but in a very intimate way, and then weave analysis through that. And I think it's a very effective way of educating people and changing minds, and particularly in the dire straits that we are currently living in, I think we really need to have a greater understanding of what's going on the ground, because you won't find that out from most mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because you also, when you went there, I mean, it's sort of, you've been there, like you said, a number of times. And this time, when you're what you're chronicling in this book, it really does, it draws the reader in, but it also just broadens things out so that you feel like you're in the middle of this, which I thought was a really important way of doing this, because you tell people something about people that they wouldn't necessarily, one, know about, or even, you know, think that there would ever be any way they would be able to hear anything other than whatever, you know, it sort of reports back on people. So let's talk about that. It was a really important way to do this.
Well, I really want people to feel like they're traveling with me. And because I'm a physician, I got into places that a lot of people don't get to. So I could be in clinics, I could be visiting families, I could be talking with psychiatrists, you know, things that most people don't do when they go to the region. And also, I'm interested in human rights, so I'm going to places where there are human rights struggles. I'm talking with human rights groups. Again, most normal tourists don't do that kind of thing. So I wanted people to hear what you learn when you do that. And I think it's really important stuff. So that's why it's all in the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, you indicate that one necessity for the book is rooted in the Zionist attempt to actually erase the Palestinian people from both mm-hmm. the pages of history and the world today. Let's talk about that.
Sure. So, you know, growing up in the U.S. and in a very traditional Jewish family, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a Palestinian. So the history that we've been taught is, you know, basically the land without a people, people without a land theory. And the idea that there was an indigenous people there, that Zionism is a complex political national movement that started in the 1800s, and that there was a lot of debate about how to keep Jews safe and what kind of Zionism to be. But the one that won out was the one to have a Jewish state and to ultimately have a Jewish state in historic Palestine. And the little part that none of us learned that I think is absolutely critical is that there were indigenous people living there and that the plan was to get rid of them. And once you get that framing, everything flows. So, you know, the war in 67 is just continuing what happened in 48. And the continued settlement growth is just a continuation of taking land, getting rid of people, taking resources, taking water, and getting rid of Palestinians. And as soon as that sort of light bulb goes off, everything makes sense in a very different way. And the other thing is that, you know, Palestinians have a reputation of being terrorists. And if you actually sit down and start meeting Palestinians and talking with people and observing life in Palestine, what you learn is that the vast, vast majority of Palestinians have no violent tendencies whatsoever. And that, in fact, Palestinian resistance is about resisting an oppressive situation, which everybody in an oppressive situation has a right to do. So it then reframes the whole conversation from poor, beleaguered Israel and these horrible terrorists to, oh, this is a colonial movement and a settler colonial state, and the indigenous people are resisting. And I think that that's a very important framing to understand when you really get on the ground and see what's going on.
Right. And I want to pursue that a little bit because, you know, one of the things I read where you said this somewhere that you want people to really understand that it's very important to understand that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not merely a matter of reconciling dueling narratives. And I think that's what you're speaking to now. It's extremely mm-hmm. important that people don't see this as like sort of equal narratives that are just dueling with one another for who's going to come out on top. But there's actual reality and there's a question of justice. There's a question of actually oppression that's going on. All of this is extremely important for people to understand. And your book takes that on in that way.
Mm-hmm. And also, if we're going to build a future, you have to understand the past. And one of the issues is that for most, you know, mainstream Jews, as well as, you know, the Israeli establishment, we can't even agree on what the past was. You know, so I'm really trying to get people to see historically what happened and then what the current reality is and then put it in a context that makes sense and it gives us options for the future. Because as long as it's the dominant country trying to get the people that lost the war to submit to their dominance, there's not going to be an end to this conflict. And so that's, you know, a basic problem. And I'm trying to address that in, as I said, a very personal, intimate kind of way.
Mm-hmm. You know, back to this point that I was making earlier around this, where the point about indicating one necessity for the book is rooted in the Zionist attempt to actually erase the Palestinian people from both the pages of history and the world today. And this point about memoricide and sociocide.
Right.
Let's
talk
about that.
So, I mean, what happened when the Israeli state was founded is that there was a big push to create a narrative that did not include the experience of the dispossession of 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of 500-plus villages. And the Israeli government had a systematic plan, which continues to today, to change all the street names, to get rid of the disappeared villages and plant Jewish National Fund forests on them, to make the fact that Palestinians were there invisible. And, you know, Israeli students do not learn that history. And, in fact, at this point, even commemorating the Nakba, which is the Arabic word for catastrophe, which is the experience of 48 for Palestinians, is a civil offense. So if you have government funding and you do that, it's a civil offense to do that. So there is an active program to make this history invisible and to not, it's like you go to a, you know, a big national park like Canada Park, and you know, there are all these different ruins. No one notes that this was three Palestinian villages. There are no little plaques there that say this, you know. So this is a big problem, because if you don't learn that history, you don't know that that's what was going on. And then you don't understand why the people displaced from three villages actually have some complaint about this, you know, and actually would like to go back to their villages, which are now forests. So it's a very powerful move to make this history not known and to keep it suppressed in physicality as well. And so if you erase the memory of people and you erase their society, then it's a form of genocide, as far as I can see. And, you know, people get very upset when I use that word, but that's what it feels like when you start listening to the narrative of Palestinians.
I think that's really important. You know, it's interesting because when you read any of Ilan Pappé's books, especially his earlier ones, where he's talking about actually what happened in 1948 and in the build up to that and what was going on there, he actually clearly indicates when you talk about the erasure, the actual erasure of entire villages, the erasure of entire groupings of people. I mean, there's one scene I remember, I can't remember where exactly it was, but it was on the Palestinians were in a town or whatever that was on a hillside, and they actually were forced into the ocean. And and it was just, and it was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. And I kept thinking about this because there is this thing again of dueling realities that keeps constantly coming up in any discussion of what's going on in that region, particularly between Israel and Palestine. And this point of, again, I wanted to talk a little bit more, see if you could expand on this in a little bit more, what you've been referring to, which the Israeli War of Independence, they call a War of Independence, and it's actually the Palestinian Nakba. And that contradiction in the process that's unleashed by that, by Israel, this is actually one of the driving forces in relation to this whole scene.
Well, I think, you know, one of the big problems in the discussion is that Jews who were living in Europe had experienced centuries of anti-Semitism and then, you know, the horrific Holocaust. And the fact of the Holocaust gave a whole movement that said, basically, you know, Jewish people need to do whatever is necessary to survive, and whatever is necessary to create a state where they will be safe. And that particular narrative is the, you know, never again for Jews rather than never again for anybody narrative. And I think the problem is that the sort of cult of victimization, which is really a part of my culture and really part of the narrative of Jewish people, is actually very destructive to our ability to move beyond the Holocaust, to recognize the humanness of Palestinians, to recognize that if you create a state with 20% of your citizens who are Palestinian and you give them second-class citizenship, that that's not a viable way to move into the future. That's going to be a chronic issue. And if you occupy people who are Palestinians in the name of Jews having a right to this land from the Bible or whatever, this is part of what people call the dual narrative. But in actuality, it's a cultural, I don't even know what it is. I think it's cultural PTSD. Sometimes I think it's a fundamentalist religion gone awry. I mean, there are a lot of different forces that go into this particular mythos, but it's not a good mythos for our own people, for our own culture.
And
that's the other side of the narrative.
Yeah, very important. And I was just going to say, now when you're talking about all this, it's really, and you do this constantly in the book, you constantly bring people back to, these are actual people that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. They're people who have been dehumanized, you know, or there's been an attempt to dehumanize them and present them as sort of, well, they're really, you know, most people have no idea what the Palestinians are doing there, why they're there, what's the beef that they have with Israel. After all, you know, Jewish people suffered through all this horror in Europe and anti-Semitism and all this, all of which is true. But then that's all bent to sort of justify that it's okay to then turn around and do the same.
Do the same.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And, you know, when no Jewish person wants to think that they're doing the same. I mean, that's really a horrible thing to think about. And so that's why it's so hard, because to have the conversation, you have to admit that there was a dispossession, there was people killed, there was a whole mass exodus out of fear and terror that was caused by a Jewish army. And, you know, no Jewish person wants to admit that that was the fact of what happened. Just like, you know, when we think in the U.S., it took so many years for us to recognize what we did to the Native Americans, or that we are founded in slavery. I mean, these are really tough, painful issues. But the problem for me with Israeli society is that struggling with these issues is not on the agenda, that the racism and discrimination is institutional. And legal. I'm sort of raising the alarm, like, wake up, people. This is, you know, you need to know this to be able to understand the dynamic.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Alice Rothschild, who's the author of an incredibly powerful new book called Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel/Palestine. Now, one thing, Alice, I wanted to pursue here, too, is that the first couple chapters of the book focus on 2013. And I like the way that you've done that in terms of the years that, you know, those 3 years and three different things that were happening, all of which were related to one another through the horrible assault on the Palestinian people. But the first couple chapters focus on 2013 and what you call the Judaization there and the master plan. And that's something I think is important for people to understand. This is not something that just sort of happens by, you know, sort of like overheated religious fervor or, mm-hmm. you know, people just wanting their land or whatever. This was actually a master plan. Let's talk about that.
Well, if you start, you know, going into archives and talking to historians and political people, what you realize is that there is a plan that involves placing Jews in areas that are traditionally Arab. So, for instance, in the city of Jaffa, which was once one of the major Arab cities in Palestine. You know, most of the population was run out in 48, and the Arabs were very ghettoized. And then as the years went by, there was further gentrification. It's actually a very beautiful place. Tel Aviv became much more prominent. And now there's active plan to move Jews into Arab neighborhoods in Jaffa and run the Arabs out. That's going on in Haifa. The whole Jewish settlement program in the West Bank is a plan to Judaize the West Bank, to create Jewish cities in occupied territories and then claim that as facts on the ground. If you look at the attacks on Bedouins in the Negev or in the Jordan Valley, you know, they're destroying Bedouin villages over and over and over again. And oftentimes they'll build a Jewish village right where the Bedouin village was with a very similar name, you know, and it's to make lay claim to the land. And it's all part of taking the land and getting rid of the people. And, it's the same theme that has gone on for decades.
Now, Alice, one thing you talk about, too, is that I guess actually more like you present the overall picture. And one of the things that really struck me is the extreme regimentation of Palestinian people. It's not like Palestinian people are just left to like loll about or something, but there's actually an extreme regimentation where prison and the military assaults and murders, but then also the role of prison is a huge factor in what's being done to the Palestinian people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you look at the numbers, it's something like 40% of males in Palestine have been arrested or detained since 1967. So it's a lot like the detention of African Americans in the U.S. It's totally disproportionate. And arrests, since the Palestinians living in the West Bank are under military rule, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rules to be broken. And some of them are, you know, singing the national anthem or throwing a stone or waving a flag. I mean, these are not major crimes. So it's very easy for Israeli soldiers to arrest Palestinians. And they also arrest kids. So there's a whole technique now that's been going on for a long time, starting when kids are young, arresting them, accusing them of crimes. Oftentimes this happens, you know, in the middle of the night. A bunch of soldiers arrive at a Palestinian home in the West Bank, you know, terrify everybody, knock down the door, grab a kid, blindfold them, and take them off to prison. And the family doesn't know where they went, what the crime was, all this stuff. And the kids are interrogated, and something like 97% of the kids do not see a lawyer until after interrogation. Physicians for Human Rights Israel has documented all sorts of horrific treatment and torture in the Israeli jails, even to children. And the kids are then either pushed to be collaborators by confessing to things and agreeing to name names, or they go to jail. This is a totally destructive policy. And, you know, the jail sentences, I mean, I think it's like 10 years for throwing a stone at a non-moving object and 20 years on a moving object. So imagine, you know, you're a 12-year-old kid, your grandfather's been humiliated at checkpoints, a settlement has stolen half your family's land, and then you throw a stone at a tank, and then you get arrested. If an Israeli kid throws a stone, there's no punishment for that. So, you know, living under military rule is really destructive in the way that people are arrested and imprisoned and pushed to be collaborators. And this then continues as people get older as well. And there's also something called administrative detention, which is arresting people, not charging them, and holding them indefinitely. And this happens often to both children and, you know, adult prisoners. And again, administrative detention is something you're supposed to use in times of national emergency, but it's used here as a way to break people. and to scare people. And so this is all very problematic if you're interested in human rights. And it's also a way to create a very angry population. So I really feel, I mean, people say, well, you're so anti-Israel. And I feel like, no, no, no. The behavior of the Israeli government is a suicidal behavior. And I'm calling attention to that because it's not going to bring anything good. And then if you look at, you know, Gaza, I mean, Gaza's basically a big open-air prison. It's totally under siege. But the metaphor doesn't even work because in a prison, the guards are responsible for feeding the prisoners and the medical care. That doesn't happen in Gaza. I mean, there are all these famous quotes about, you know, the Gazans were put on a diet. They get just enough calories not to starve to death. I mean, it's a massive humanitarian crisis. I was there in January. I was there 2 years ago, right after the war. I mean, it is a catastrophe. And people are getting up in the morning and they're going to school and they're going to the hospital and they're getting their college degrees and they're trying to farm and they're trying to fish. And they really are an incredibly resilient people. But there's so much trauma and there's so much destruction of the infrastructure. And there are daily assaults. And, you know, there's a lot of talk that another war in Gaza is brewing. And when I was in Gaza, you know, all the talk was, when's the next war? I mean, people are so fearful of that and so traumatized by we had 3 wars in 6 years, and the last one was really devastating civilian infrastructure. So, you know, this is all part of the imprisoning virtually or actually the whole population. And it's just, people don't understand that. You know, and I visited Ofer Prison in January to watch the hearings. And, you know, the thing that struck me was that the process was so banal. You know, no one was sobbing or outraged. It was like people just have been beaten into, you know, keeping their heads down, hoping that their lawyer can get them a short sentence. No one's asking, like, is it really right to imprison a kid for 10 years for throwing a stone? Is that really the right thing to do? I mean, so it's a system that's gone astray, as far as I can tell. And it's all part of what I see as the overall problem.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that the other part of this, I mean, it really is, I was stunned, and I have followed Palestine for quite some time, but I was still, it still took me back, even though I know that this happens, but the whole, basically the military assault and murder that has been unleashed on against the Palestinian people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost when you're reading that, it's like, okay, even though you know it, but when you're reading it and you're reading the kinds of things that are happening, including, I mean, there was one passage in there where there was somebody who was, I guess it was at Ramadan, and they were having the meal at the end of the day, and then all of a sudden their house was bombed and 24 or 28 people were just eliminated off the face of the earth. And this was something that was going on throughout the entire area of Gaza. Let's talk about this, because that's something that really is the dehumanization. And it's very heavy, because this is, the Zionists are always trying to say, you know, the call back on the horrible things that were done to Jewish people throughout Europe in World War II, and as well as the anti-Semitism that exists today. But also they're constantly posing that stuff. But at the same time, they are actually eliminating and erasing the Palestinian people through the most horrendous things, including outright military assault and murder.
Right. So, I mean, in the last war in Gaza, there were some 1,500 civilians that were killed, 500 children. And you can talk about smart weapons and targeted whatever, but if you see the level of human death and also the level of infrastructure destruction, this was an assault on civilians. And I think you have to be honest that that's what the wars in Gaza are actually about. And, you know, using the excuse of there are rockets coming from Gaza, we have to stop them. The way to stop them is to stop the siege and to have political solutions and to negotiate with Hamas, which at this point is a moderating force in Gaza, keeping the much more militant people from doing things much worse. So the whole approach is really, really destructive to the society and to the people. And in the West Bank, you see repeated episodes of Israeli soldiers shooting to kill and shooting Palestinians that are already bleeding on the ground. And there was recently a soldier who had shot a Palestinian who was already bleeding and lying on the ground. He got 18 months for shooting someone in the head, which was basically an extrajudicial assassination. You know, when a kid gets 10 years for throwing a stone and a soldier gets 18 months for killing someone who's already half dead, there's a real problem in the soldier understanding that that's a human being that he's shooting and that that's just completely not acceptable behavior. So there are, you know, weekly shootings like that soldiers get away with because Palestinians are looked at as less human. And one of the things that was fascinating for me is I was in the region in 2014 in June during the run-up to the war. So I got to, although I, you know, I couldn't foresee the future, but you could see that what was happening was we were sort of getting ready for a war. And one of the things that was so horrifying for me was the way that politicians were talking about Palestinians. They were calling them snakes. You know, they were talking about shoot a pregnant woman because then you kill two people. You know, I mean, it was just, this is horribly racist kind of behavior and verbiage. And it's not the way you make peace with your neighbor. So you see this both in the West Bank and in Gaza and, you know, in East Jerusalem as well. And also Palestinians in Israel don't get treated the same way Jews do. I mean, if you're a Bedouin living in the Negev in an unrecognized village, your village may have been destroyed, you know, 50, 60 times. And that would never happen to a Jewish village. And you can imagine the trauma of the kids and the humiliation of the father and all the things that go on when that kind of behavior is the norm. And it is the norm. And so it's highly problematic. And you could live in Tel Aviv and live a very lovely life and never know that this is all happening. And so there's a real blindness that is very problematic. I mean, we, you know, we're not any better. I mean, we can be blind to what's happening in our cities as well. So I'm not saying that Israelis are better or worse than we are, but I'm calling attention to this blindness to what's going on right in front of their faces.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because the other thing around this calling Palestinian people snakes is that basically this is also a way that, that the people are dehumanized. That actually helps pave the way. It actually softens the concept of genocide. We're going to carry out genocide against these people, but it doesn't matter because they're snakes. They're not human. They're less than human.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
That, yeah.
Right. And, you know, the other thing that's really fascinating to me is that half of Israelis came from Arab-speaking countries or northern Africa. And when they became Jewish Israelis, and when they became Israelis, they lose their Arabization. They get de-Arabized. And so it's so interesting. I could be, I've talked with, like, you know, a taxi driver whose, you know, mother was from Syria and his father was from, his grandfather was from Iraq. And I would say, so you're an Arab Jew? And he went, no, I'm an Israeli. You know, so there's this othering of anyone who is Arab, even when half of the Jews are not from Eastern Europe, you know. So it's a very interesting mindset that enables people to think this way and to dehumanize the other, even when they're dehumanizing a part of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, does that tie into with this point that you've made in the book that nationality trumps citizenship, that that's a big thing that the Zionists actually keep pumping out is that nationality trumps citizenship?
Right. So one of the things that most people don't understand, and it took me, you know, several years to really wrap my brain around this, is that if you are a citizen of Israel, it's very different than being a citizen of, you know, the UK or the United States or whatever, because you have citizenship and then you have nationality. So if you're a Jewish Israeli, your Jewish nationality is the thing that counts. And the reason this is important is that in the state of Israel, it's not a state of equal citizens. And the way they get around that is that they favor the Jewish nationality over, they have something like 130-something other nationalities, and the Jews get favored in the institutions, legally, whatever, over all the other nationalities. So they sort of sweep the idea of citizenship and democracy under the rug by having this nationality category. And nationality is more important than citizenship.
Yeah. There's a couple things I wanted to find out, and one of them just keeps popping into my head, and I keep forgetting to ask you. But there's also the fact that water, a basic need for humanity on the globe, and that is actually a major issue in relation to the Palestinian people and the Zionist rulers.
In the Middle East, water is a very critical resource. And what we see in this region is that water is basically used as a weapon. So one of the outcomes of the Oslo Accords was that the Israelis have control over the aquifers in the West Bank, which provide a huge amount of water for Israel. And then Palestinians have to buy back the water that's sitting under their villages at high price from Israeli companies in order to have water. The other thing is, besides a price difference, there's an allotment difference. So if you're a Jewish settler living in the West Bank in a settlement, you have a green lawn, you have a swimming pool, you have hot water in your shower, you have a first world relationship to water. If you're a Palestinian living in the village next door, you get much less water at much higher price. And you can look up and see the lawn of the settlement, and you don't have any water to wash your dishes. So there's this tremendous discrepancy between the allotment of water for Jews versus Palestinians. And that is using water as a weapon. And if you look at what's going on in Gaza, the water treatment facilities have been bombed and the sewer treatment facilities have been bombed. And the Gazan aquifer cannot support the number of people that are living in Gaza, which is now 2 million. So at this point, 95% of the water in Gaza is not drinkable. So the UN estimates that Gaza will be uninhabitable by 2020, which is not that far away. Mm. So you can just imagine the catastrophe that is brewing there over the issue of water. And the other thing is that because the treatment sewer treatment facilities were bombed and the Israelis don't allow enough materials to come in to fix everything that they keep bombing, raw sewage pours into the Mediterranean Sea. So the waters where the fishermen fish are now polluted with sewage. And because the Israelis keep shrinking the buffer zone where the how far out the fishermen can go, and they shoot at them if they go beyond whatever the number of miles is that day, the ability for Gazans to have fish, which it was, you know, it was a big fishing economy, it's on the coast, has been dramatically shrunken. So it just increases the impoverishment, increases the need for food aid. You know, it's, again, using water as a weapon. And you see this over and over again in lots of different ways. And the irony is, if you look at the PR, you know, Israelis are the high-tech nation. They do all sorts of fabulous water technology. They've made the Negev bloom. But, you know, where is that water from? A lot of it's from the West Bank. So it's a kind of amazing PR campaign so that most people think of Israelis and water as a looking to the future, and that's what the PR is. But in actuality, it's much more sinister than that.
Mm-hmm. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I did want to say something about the BDS movement, but I don't think we'll be able to get into that much unless you can do something very short, because I do know that that is what I read in your book, and this was really very cool to read about how much the Palestinian people actually value and respect and see the need for and are grateful for this kind of movement around the world that's actually recognizing mm-hmm. what's happening to them. Very, very, very important.
Right. So, I mean, very briefly, you know, when people criticize Palestinians for being violent resistors, they are told they can't do that. And then they are resisting nonviolently, which is what boycott, divestment, sanction is about, and they're told they can't do that. So you can't have it both ways. So for me, BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanction, is a really positive force. And it's getting much more power internationally. And it has also begun to have results. And it's, you know, people say it's anti-Semitic. It's not anti-Semitic. It's about criticizing Israel for having an occupation and a siege and second-class citizenship of Palestinians who are in the state, and also not resolving the refugee crisis. These are the things that every peace agreement knows that we have to resolve. So it's about pushing the political process forward. And so I think it's a very exciting development, and it's what Palestinian civil society activists are calling the international community to do, and it's our job to take heed.
Now, let me ask you this one thing, and again, we'll really have to be fast on this one, but this is, you make a point here that complicity through either ignorance or silence is a dangerous position in this complicated world. And I think that's extremely important for people to understand, especially these days, that complicity through either ignorance or silence is a dangerous position. Let's talk about that in relation to what's happening, what you've been writing about in relation to the mm-hmm. Palestinian people.
So, in this particular situation, Israel, backed by the U.S., has the power to change the dynamic. And so if we don't say anything and don't educate ourselves on what's happening and how the U.S. is complicit in all of this happening, because we fund the occupation and support it politically, then we are complicit in the fact that it exists. And so I think it's part of being a citizen of the world and paying attention internationally to issues of peace and justice is to take a position on this particular conflict. And if you don't, then the country that's in power, the country that is maintaining an occupation, a siege, whatever, if you don't say anything, then you're complicit with what their behavior is. And I think that's a very important point on all conflicts, that you have to pay attention to the human rights issues and speak up for the people who are the victim of human rights abuses.
Mm-hmm. All right, Alice Rothschild, thank you very much for joining us today and for the book. Very, very,
thank you.
A lot of thanks for that, okay?
Thank you so much. All right. Take care.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Alice Rothschild, who's the author of the book Condition Critical, Life and Death in Israel/Palestine.
We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride. When I saw that checkpoint, welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you'll get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children going adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint. And pray that red light turns green at the checkpoint. And Martin Luther King had a dream of the checkpoint. He wake with loud screams from the scenes at the checkpoint. Is Malcolm X by any means at the checkpoint?
All right, welcome back. That was Jasiri X with Checkpoint, just a very powerful song that I never get tired of hearing, and one that you shouldn't get tired of either. Now we're going to have a very special segment of the show. It's an interview I did with a man named Salman Abu Sita, and this interview was done back in 2013. Now, anyone with an interest in the Palestine-Israel situation is likely to have heard of Salman Abu Sita. For decades, his name has been a byword for a cogent, reasoned insistence on the legality, morality, and practicality of the right of return of Palestinian refugees. He's a Palestinian researcher most known for his groundbreaking project mapping historic Palestine and developing a practical plan for implementing the right of return of Palestinian refugees. Abu Sita has spent 40 years digging for any detail of information about or related to Palestine before, during, and after the Nakba, the destruction of Palestine. Abu Sita's work has encompassed not only documenting the Nakba, in which over 800,000 Palestinians were largely driven from their homes and villages, but also ensuring that the memories and identity of the occupied homeland are never lost. He is the author of many books on Palestine, and most recently of Mapping My Return, a Palestinian memoir by Salman Abu Sita. Now, as I said, this interview was recorded back in 2013, so sit back and listen up, because I guarantee you, there's nothing like getting a good dose of the truth.
So I decided that I'd go back and talk to someone who's been deeply involved in and knowledgeable about the original land seizure of Palestine by Zionist forces backed up by various imperialist powers around the world, including most essentially the U.S. imperialists. That's what contextualizes the whole situation in Palestine today, the theft of the Palestinian land in order to establish the state of Israel. Now, to start things off, I'm going to read a few sentences from an article recently written by my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and director of the Palestine Land Society. In May 2012, Senator Mark Kirk made an astounding discovery, which had escaped scores of politicians, diplomats, and experts for six decades. He discovered that the number of Palestinian refugees is not 5 million, as United Nations Relief and Works Agency records show, but merely 30,000. The credit for this discovery goes to AIPAC and Israel, as they had advanced this so-called discovery for the last 4 months. Kirk took the signal and proposed a motion to Congress, which was passed after a mild amendment. Dispossessed Palestinians will remain dispossessed Palestinians with no recourse. Those are the words of my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine. Salman, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Let's jump right into this. When I read your article, it was like sticking a pin in my eye. I paid a lot of attention to what's going on with the Palestinian people, and then seeing this just drove home again this whole question of the dispossession of the Palestinian people, and I wanted to talk with you about it. You make the point, you say it's impossible to examine the Palestinian land ownership in occupied Palestine outside the context of the general Palestine-Israel conflict. Can you explain what you mean there and why you say that?
The tragedy of Palestine is very clear. In 1948, Israeli forces, mainly composed of Jewish immigrants from Europe, took over Palestine by force, by military force. They have depopulated 675,000 villages within 6 months of 1948. Thus, we have the problem of refugees. The purpose of Zionism is threefold. Number one, to take over the land of Palestine. Two, to get rid of the people of Palestine by resettlement anywhere else except in their homes is to erase their history and memory. And so we have, in this case, the largest, most comprehensive, meticulously executed ethnic cleansing in modern history. And this problem persists today. 64 years later, the Palestinians are unable to go back and live in their own homes. The land which is called Israel today, 93% of it is Palestinian-owned. And this is the land of the refugees who are now scattered around Palestine and elsewhere.
Let's talk about this a little bit more, because you just made the statement that this, the expulsion of the Palestinian people, the seizure of the land, the theft of the land, was the largest planned, comprehensive, and still continuous ethnic cleansing operation in modern history. Can you get into that a little bit more? How did that play out?
In 1948, the Israeli forces occupied 78% of Palestine. In 1967, they occupied all of Palestine and parts of Syria and Sinai and later part of Lebanon. Now they still have 100% of Palestine and all Golan Heights in Syria. Now the whole world, through the international community, has declared that this is illegal under international law. The International Court of Justice has made a specific decree that the occupation of the West Bank by Israel and indeed all of Palestine is illegal under international law. There are more than 135 UN resolutions confirming or affirming the right of Palestinians to return to their homes, but Israel never complied with that, although it is a condition for its membership in the United Nations. Why it didn't do that? Because of the support of the United States through the Israel lobby in the United States.
Now, one of the things, though, it wasn't like they just walked in and started buying up the land, or they started just telling Palestinians, well, sorry, but we own your house now, you got to get out. When you're talking about ethnic cleansing, you're talking about something that actually is a crime against humanity. It's actually something that the Nuremberg Tribunal basically said that this was a criminal act. And the Israelis were very, very, very vicious in the cleansing of Palestine. You refer to something in one of your pieces, you refer to something called the Green Patrol, which gave me a very sharp example of how they carried this out. Can you tell my listeners what the Green Patrol is and what it had to do with ethnic cleansing?
Before the Green Patrol, which started in 1950, in 1948, the Israelis carried out 31 military operations to take over 78% of Palestine. In each of these operations, at the beginning and in the middle, they have committed a massacre of a village, a total of about 77 atrocities and massacres. This was intended to propel the people and make them leave their homes. In fact, each village, the standard procedure was that each village was surrounded from three times, and the fourth side is left open for people to escape. They would kill a number of young men, and they take the rest to concentration camps where they were taken to forced labor camps. We have uncovered five visited by the Red Cross, and we have the documents in Geneva to prove it, but we have also uncovered 17 other forced labor camps through the testimony of the witnesses. Now, all this was carried out in 1948-49. If anyone tried to return home, they were shot and killed by the Israelis as being infiltrators. If you return to your home, you are an infiltrator. But the one who came from Europe through the shores of Palestine, infiltrated into the land of Palestine, is not considered to be an infiltrator. Now, after 1950, some Palestinians remained, very, very few, or almost 10 or 15%. When these people remained on their own land, the Israelis created something called Green Patrol, which went around and demolished their houses and actually put toxic material in their crops and killed their cattle in order to make them move. These were and are Israeli citizens. That happened after 1948, and these people were not refugees, but Israeli citizens. So this process, as you have said, is continuous until today. Today is also carried out not only inside Israel, in Al-Araqib, in Beersheba district, but also in Jerusalem and the West Bank.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because it plays out in these examples. For instance, one thing that we hear a lot about is the so-called Israeli settlers that move into the occupied territories and then claim them as their holy land, their promised land, and they get backed up by the military. And there's a constant confrontation with the Palestinian people who are saying, no, get out. Do you see this as a continuation of that same ethnic cleansing?
It is absolutely a continuation. It is done today through slightly different means. Instead of being a military force in 1948 and 49, it's done now by subtle ways and not so subtle ways. Let us remember that the International Court of Justice in 2004 has clearly declared that the occupation of the West Bank is illegal under international law. And that means under the Rome Statute of 1998, which is the foundation of the International Criminal Court, declares clearly that the people of the occupier or the occupying force should not be settled on the occupied land. If they do, this is, of course, a crime against humanity, a crime against peace, and a war crime. Therefore, legally speaking, all the settlers in the West Bank are war criminals. And the Israelis deny that the West Bank is an occupied territory. They are the only people who claim that. Even the United States doesn't claim that. The whole world claims it is an occupied territory. So here you have not only the settlers taking Palestinian land in the land that was occupied in 1967, but also they take their water. 90% of the water of the West Bank is taken over by the Israelis, and they are left thirsty. Not only that, even South Africa did not dare to do that. They have Jews-only roads. If you are a Palestinian in the West Bank, you are not allowed to drive on roads allocated for Jews. When Bishop Desmond Tutu visited, he said, I know apartheid very well, but this is in the West Bank and Palestine. This is worse than apartheid.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Salman Abusita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and people of Palestine. And we're talking about the ethnic cleansing that is a continuous thing going on in Palestine and the Zionist forces behind it from the very beginning. Now, Salman, you talked about this, the objectives of the Zionist master plan of ethnic cleansing, and you went through them, the land to conquer it, confiscate it, deny its original ownership, the people to kill them in massacres, expel them, chase them into exile or make their lives unbearable. There's also this thing about the identity and to erase any physical sign of the Palestinian presence, destruction of villages, monuments, holy sites, to change maps and delete Arabic names and replace them with Hebrew names and erase their mention in history and geography books. And I noticed that a lot of your writing really concentrates on trying to combat that. Why is this so important? Why did the Zionists go after this so hard?
Well, from the beginning of the 20th century, the Zionists have sold the European politicians, colonial politicians, the idea that Palestine is a land without people and the Jews are people without land, therefore let us get the two together. Now, this is a myth, and this myth was well known to the colonial powers themselves, the British and the French, because in the 19th century, they made surveys of Palestine, and they found, and we have all the maps today, they found that there are 1,000 towns and villages in Palestine, and some of them are actually recorded and known since the times of Jesus Christ. Now, why do they do that? Because they wanted to prove that they have not committed a sin or a crime against anybody. This is an empty territory. Now, we have to show that this is, of course, entirely false. So I worked for almost 20 years collecting documents from various European capitals, but mainly England and the United Nations and New York, Washington, in order to reconstruct the maps of Palestine, which has been erased by the Zionists. We have great difficulty because we are not yet a state, and I'm only a researcher, and therefore I have no authority to demand documents from government. But over 20 years, we have assembled the Atlas of Palestine, 1917 to 1960, 700 pages. It has the following. It has 1,600 towns and villages. It has 16,000 historical and religious monuments, and it has 26,000 place names. All these names, a total of about 50,000, are what I call the vocabulary of the social history of Palestine. It was not created by committee. It was created by the people in their course of life. For example, the Pigeon Valley, the Olive Fields, and so on and so forth. And this is, to me, a great testimony of the life of the people who have been rooted in Palestine for thousands of years. when Ben-Gurion was told that we have taken over Palestine and people will not accept it, he said, the young will forget and the old will die. Well, they all did die, but not before they tell their children about their patrimony, and the Atlas is a record of this patrimony.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, and we're talking about the dispossession of the land and people of Palestine. Now, Salman, we have a couple of questions left to ask, and one is, there's always the thing that the U.S. imperialists are always putting out to people and always putting out around the world, and the Israelis are right behind them and pumping it out. The only democratic regime in the entire Middle East, you know, whatever. The whole idea that the people who are living in Israel and in occupied Palestine, that they have recourse to legal rights. Yet, I'd ask you this. The situation, as you say, continues to be ethnic cleansing. What legal recourse do the Palestinian people have today in occupied Palestine, in what the Zionists call Israel?
You know, let me say this. Israel is the only racist country in the world today. There are many countries which practice racism in a subtle way and in a social way. But Israel is the only race country through its institutions and through its laws. There are 25 basic laws in Israel, at least, which discriminate against anyone who is not a Jew. Even though, and this applies to Jews who are not also citizens of Israel, they have the same rights like Jews who are in Israel. These basic laws discriminate against anybody who is not a Jew in the following manner: in the land ownership, in the land use, in education, in health, in employment, in family unity. If you are married to a Palestinian woman from the West Bank, you cannot bring your wife to Israel if you are Palestinian living there. But a Jew can bring an Australian or an American wife or anywhere from anywhere to Israel. The world has condemned Israel so many times in the Human Rights Council, and only last week, CERD, which is the Committee for Elimination of All Traces of Racism, has censored Israel very clearly about its practices. And this practice is continuing on today. You probably recall the case of a village called Araqib in Beersheba, and the Israeli government demolished the village for over 36 times. And this is obviously has been also condemned by European Parliament only last week. So Israel has the dubious distinction of being the most racist state in the world. The people in Europe and somewhat in America have, because of internet and television and so on, have really seen the reality behind the myth that Israel is democracy. And 70% of people in Europe say that Israel is a danger to the world peace.
Let me ask you this, Salman. Real quick, you made a comment in a couple of your writings, in a couple of places, you made the comment that the Palestinians cannot depend on the Israeli legal system because Israeli law is the law of the conqueror, and it's designed to deprive the vanquished of their rights. And you also made a similar point around international law. Can you talk about that a little bit as the last question?
Yes. There is a simple adage which we can find somewhat useful here. I say, under the robber's law, you cannot retrieve the stolen goods. And this has been proven over and over again. But if you allow me, just let me say one thing before we go. There is now, by the Israeli lobby and Israeli supporters in the United States, a vicious campaign against UNRWA. Why is that? Because UNRWA is the last element of the international law about Palestine, which is in operation. And as in a typical crime, if you find the body of the victim, then there is a crime. So the Israeli supporters are trying to eliminate the body of the victim. And if there is no UNRWA, there is no refugees, and therefore there is no crime. And this, of course, is a vain hope, because Palestinians are not only 5 as registered with the United Nations, but they are 7.4 million, because some of them are not registered. And I have shown this in the Atlas, because it's very simple exercise. The British have made a census in 1945, and we have the names of villages from which people were expelled, and we can know these villages and the population they're from. And we can calculate that. It is found in one of my books called the Nakba Register. And the fact that they have stayed 64 years away from their homes and they have no intention of abandoning their right to go to their homes, which are very frequently a few miles away, then the peace can never come to the Middle East without the return of the refugees to their homes, which is a basic and fundamental human right.
Okay, Salman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, and keep up your work and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, a group dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine.
I want to thank my guests for today's show, Salman Abu Sita and Alice Rothschild. I also want to thank all those folks who worked on the show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board out for today, Kiana Williams. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And please do write, because I look forward to hearing from you. We're going to go out now with Troubled Times from Green Day. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show, and it's been a very powerful show as far as I'm concerned, and I hope you agree. Now, there's a couple of things I wanted to say. One is that we just got word that Lynn Steward, a people's attorney, a lawyer who always fought for the oppressed and stood up fearlessly against this system and all the savage harm it brought down on the people of the world, Lynn Steward. Lynn spent her entire life fighting for justice and fighting for a whole better world. And for the years she spent fighting against the oppression of people everywhere, Lynn Steward was forced into a long jail term by this system, and one that only ended when she developed the final stages of her cancer. And she passed away in New York City. Lynn Steward, a genuine fighter for the people and for a better world, who will always be loved and remembered. We're going to go out now with Troubled Times from Green Day. If we